Okay, we're beginning here on the bottom of Mem Aleph Bet. The Gemara begins, Shlosha lekuchot mitzdarfim. If you have three different buyers, they together can create the 3 years of chazakah that you need. Amarav v'chulan b'shtar. They all need to have indications of the fact that they own the property through a shtar. The Memra, the Savarav, shtar itle kala. Ve'idim le'luhu kala. From this, it sounds like that Rav requires the sale be done in a documented manner, that there actually be a shtar, that only through a shtar will you gain the type of pirsum, publicity that you need in order to have the individual who was the original owner of the property object to your being there. You need enough publicity, the fact that these individuals are found in this property. So from this, it sounds like that Rav, who requires that they have a shtar for each one of the transactions, that the publicity or the issue only comes to the forefront if it was done through a shtar. But if it was done through a dim, that would not be sufficient, or it wouldn't be enough of a kol, quote, quote, to have it disseminate the information so that it establishes a chazakah. This is a case where Shimon claims he bought it from Reuven, he sold it to Levi, Levi sold it to Yehuda. All of the latter transactions we have shtarot for. So that means that Yehuda bought it from Levi with the shtar. Levi bought it from Shimon with the shtar. Shimon claims he bought it from Reuven originally. So now the three other parties, Shimon, Levi, and Yehuda, have been in the property for 3 years, each one a year. Together, they've been in the property for 3 years. The latter two have shtarot to indicate that they purchased the property. So now there's 3 years of individuals living on this property. There was an exchange between them that moved it from one ownership to the other, but in Sach HaKol, the totality, there's been 3 years where the owner of the property, or the original owner of the property, has not objected to the fact that other people have been on his property for a sequence of 3 years, even though each one of them was a different party. So the Mara wants to understand that, v'amarav, mocher sadeh be'edim, goveh minichasim mishubadim. This takes us back to something that we've discussed many times, which is that when an individual sells property, or a person engages in a loan, we're going to see in a second, the publicity is a necessary aspect of these transactions. Again, when you don't have an ability to have a title be filed, but have some sort of repository where you can check people's ownership or determine if there's a lien on the property, the only way for this information to get disseminated is in a case where it's done in a public manner. So over here, where you say, Amarav mocher sadeh be'edim, a person who sells property with edim, goveh minichasim mishubadim. If in that contract of sale, there was what was called achrayut nichasim, there was a guarantee to ensure that the party that bought the property gets the property, and if it is taken away from him, meaning that there's some other lien on the property, or some reason that the property is confiscated, that the seller of the property to him will replace the property, either pay him back or replace the property. So what we're worried about here is the achriyut nichasim. As far as the property that's sold, that's not really what the issue is. The issue is that now that he sold the property, subsequent buyers of his property or subsequent lenders to him are all going to be subordinated to the lien of this first party, because his lien precedes anyone else's lien, because of the fact that he purchased the property with achrayut. Achrayut means that this person has a lien back on the seller to get whatever it is to ensure that he is holding the property and that he's repaid for that property. Truth is that achrayut nechasim, according to the way that we paskin, it's a machlok at other places in Shas, is a ta'ot sofer. Even if it's not included in the document, we assume it is supposed to be in the document. And therefore we would assume that if there was a documented transaction between parties, then there would be achrayut nechasim. Over here, there's no shtar because it's mocher tasadeh be'edim. So what you see here is, even with the lack of a shtar, Rav says that the edim suffice for there to be publicity to know that this person has a lien on the property. So why before does he say shtar, no edim? Over here he says edim work or sufficient to generate the publicity that we need. Mar says, Hotam lekuchot inu afsidu anafshayu. The buyers cause their own losses, which is the fact that when they come in to purchase property after him, they need to do a little bit of investigating. They need to look into the matter a little bit. If they did a little research, then they would have known the answer to the question. People don't throw away their money willy-nilly. Before they make a purchase, they check into whether this seller of the property has any other outstanding liens or other issues with regards to his credit. Had they just checked into it a little bit, they would have gotten the information. So what we're saying is that there's a difference between active and passive publicity, which is that when someone needs to actively engage and look into the matter, we are going to assume that if there were a deem there, he'll get the information. The information is public enough that he will discover the information. On the other hand, when you're looking for a passive dissemination of information, a deem are not sufficient in that. There, Rab wants a shtar in order to make it a seriously public issue. So that's why the difference, in the case of micha'ah, which is a passive publicity, the person who owns the property is not looking to find out if somebody's stealing his property. He's not trying to check out and see that someone's done something with his property because he believes he owns his property. He doesn't think anything otherwise. So the only way to establish a chazakah is to have publicity, which is guaranteed to reach him, or so obvious that he would have known about that. That comes through a shtar. The assumption is when you have a shtar already, it involves enough people that it's going to become public. You have a minimum of three. So at a minimum of three already, he's considered to be gilui milta. That's considered to be something that's of public nature. A deem cannot generate that type of publicity. On the other hand, if you have a transaction that took place and someone's coming out to purchase after that fact, and they're looking into the matter and they're checking it out, that information is sufficient with a deem to be available to them. And therefore, they don't need a shtar to know about it. Even a deem will make them aware of the fact that there was a transaction that preceded them. And that's sufficient information. And that's why the kuchot are the ones who they lost it themselves or caused themselves the problem. They didn't look sufficiently into the issue. All right, so now, given that differential, the Gemara says, Mi amar Rav Hachi. Did Rav really say this? Did Rav really indicate the fact that a shtar generates publicity because of the fact that everybody gathers around to sign it, to write it, everything? It's a big public affair versus a deem, which are not such a public affair. They do have information that can be made public in an active manner. If someone engages them, they'll have the information, but passively, that won't disseminate the information. Vatznan, don't we have a Mishnah? Amalvet chavero b'shtar. Person who lends his friend money with a shtar, goveh minichasim mishubadim ayedei deem, goveh minichasim b'nei chorin. So this seems to upend what we just said with Rab before. Here you have a situation in which you have a deem engaged in the situation, and there Rab says, if the person lends his friend bishtar, then you can go after the encumbered property. That has enough publicity by which, if the subsequent buyers came along and bought property, they have to know they're at risk for their property being confiscated, or they have to leave sufficient property behind by which this person can come and collect his loan. On the other hand, if it was done with a deem, then he only has a right to collect from unencumbered property. We don't have this view that all of a sudden the deem make it public enough that you can go after encumbered property. So here you have three different memorot from Rav that seem to contradict the other. Just have the first memorot of Rav, which says that in the case of establishing a chazakah, you need shtar. Edim are not sufficient. And the second memorot of Rav that we saw, someone who sells a field with achrayut, which in essence creates an encumbrance, a lien on the property, over there, edim sufficed in order to generate enough kol. And we answered the difference was between establishing a chazakah, which is a passive dissemination of information. There you need shtar. In the case of the kuchot, it's their responsibility to go look. So now here we have a case where someone's lending money. And again, the lukochot are the ones that are responsible to look into the matter. These are buyers after the loan was extended, and they are at risk for this lien that's on the property. Yet Rav says shtar is sufficient type of publicity, and edim are not sufficient publicity. Why not? If the lukochot, the buyers, are after the fact going to check out the information, they'll know something happened. They were edim to it. They'll get the information. Why is this different? V'chi teima Rav. Tanohu upali. So what are you going to suggest now? That Rav himself is a Tano, has the status of a Tano, and therefore this Mishnah does not present the problem from him. So this is the issue that comes up in Jewish history, where we have certain periods of time, and during those periods of time, we have decisors, or we have opinions that are given, and then you cross over some sort of threshold, and we moved into a new era. So over here, we'll talk about the Tanaim moving into the Amoraim. Amoraim moved into the Saboraim, into the Gonim, and then into the Rishonim. Each one of those changes has a certain protocol that comes with it, which is that once you cross over that line, if you're in the latter group, you're not allowed to argue on the previous group. You have to reconcile with the previous group somehow. You can't argue with them. You can amalgamate. You can draw parallels, contrasts. You can do whatever you want, but you have to somehow abide or fit into the previous generation. That means an Amora cannot argue on a Tano. An Amora must follow at least one Tanaic position. He can't take a position that is opposed to all the Tanaim, because he's already in that next generation. I mean, that he can take a position between Tanaim and say, I hold like this Tana, not that Tana, right. But he can't take a position that's opposed to all the Tanaim. Where you have the problem are people who sit at that line, at that threshold line. Where are they? Are they one side of the line or the other side of the line? So we know it's clear that Rabbi was a Tana. We also know that many of Rabbi's students were also Tanaim. You have Rabbi Chiya, you have Levi, a number of other individuals who are classified as Tanaim, being the Talmidim of Rabbi. Rav is a Talmid of Rabbi. But we also know that Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish were younger Talmidim of Rabbi, much later on. They speak about Rav being at the front of the class and being a superstar, and Rabbi Shir when they sat in the back. But we know for sure Reish Lakish and Rabbi Yochanan are classified as Amoraim. So here you have a demarcation, even within the students of Rabbi, the latter students are clearly Amoraim, the earlier students are Tanaim, Rav sits between his uncle Rabbi Chiya, who is clearly a Tana, a Talmid of Rabbi, versus Reish Lakish and Rabbi Yochanan, who are much younger than him, who are clearly Amoraim. So Rav's status is really on the threshold, somewhat questionable as to where he is in that line, and therefore the Gemara in a number of places uses this terminology that Rav Tanahu Poli. The truth is that he also is credited with writing the Midrash Halacha on Vayikra, where it says, Islam Sifra de Bei Rav, that he's credited with a work that is equivalent or understanding of a Tana. Once you do that, Rav's Poseach HaShtei HaSipim, he is straddling the two worlds, and so generally we don't allow Rav to argue on Tanaim. But occasionally, the Gemara will make a suggestion like this, that Rav Tana Hu Polik. Gemara says, Vaha Rav Ushmo Damrei Tavayu. So if you think that Rav Tana Hu Polik, so that we could dismiss the Mishnah and just say Rav argues on the Mishnah, problem is that Rav and Shmo themselves make a statement that seems to corroborate what we saw in the Mishnah, which is, Mil ve'al peh, eino govel lo min ha-miyorshim, ve'lo min ha-lukuchot. An oral extension of loan. You may not go after inheritors, you may not go after lekuchot, you may not have to go after buyers, which means basically that you do not have a lien on this property that entitles you to take from future buyers or future borrowers. You don't have any rights here because it was done ba'al peh. It was done orally. Now, the truth is, if there were no edim, then you wouldn't even have a question at all. But the assumption is that at least he had edim. Nobody lends money without either edim or a shtar. So at least they were edim there. Still, what we see here is Rav's corroboration of what we saw in the Mishnah. So now you have a problem because you have these three different statements that are attributed to Rav, and they're hard to reconcile. The Gemara says it's not a problem at all. Milve azvine karamit? What do you mean? When you're talking about a loan versus a transaction, those are different animals. Milve kika yosef, bitzina ka yosef. When someone borrows money, they do it privately. This is not the type of thing that you want to make public. There are a number of reasons not to do that. One is that you don't want people to know that you're in need. But the more likely reason is that Ben Gershom brings it over here, the Rishbam brings it here as well. The Aliyade Inche du Chayab Mamon. People know that you have debts outstanding. Kishir Tzelim Kor Karka Mipnei Chovotav. When you want to sell assets to raise the cash to pay back those loans, you mezalzalim b'nechasav. They know you're under pressure for cash now, and they're going to put pressure on the price of your property. They're going to try to buy it at a lower price. They know he's under pressure from the creditors, and therefore they're going to try to swing a deal in that case. That's why people, when they borrow money, do it quietly or privately, so others don't know that they might be under pressure, and that when they go to sell land, they won't be pressured to liquidate their assets at a discounted price. So that his property doesn't depreciate in value. Now, it's not just simply that his property doesn't depreciate in value, that people don't look at him as a good counterparty, but rather that they know that he might be under pressure. And the debt is going to cause him pressure, and that pressure is going to lower the price of the value of his properties. That's what the Rabbeinu Gershom just explained to us. Zvine mandazovin ara b'farhesia zovin. On the other hand, a person who sells property will do it in a public manner. so that it becomes a matter of the public record. So that could be for a number of reasons. The way that the Rabbeinu Gershom explains it is, Aval gabe mocher shiny, demanda zavin, shekonim karka befeasya zavin, ki eched de nepukle kala, de inish amidhu. He wants to get a name as being a rich individual. Ho bezavim e karke, and then he purchases properties. He's a transactor in properties. Ho yo vechein ayelo lelokeach achar libdok. Because of that, the person has to check into it. Meaning that he will make it a matter of the public record, because it gives him an advantage when he goes into other transactions that people trust him or know him as a real estate mogul or somebody who has a transaction. Others explain simply that he wants to auction the property. The way to garner the highest price when you're selling a property is to auction it to multiple parties. It's not to sell it in a private sale, but rather have multiple bidders come onto the property. So he has a vested interest in publicizing the fact that he's selling it so that he gets more bidders on the property. Or the third possibility is the buyer is interested in it being publicized because he wants to become clear of the public record that the ownership has transferred. He doesn't have to, this whole thing with the chazakah and all the other questions, if it was done in such a public manner, then the lokeach has a lot more security in the fact that his purchase will become a part of the public record and he won't have to prove his ownership. Nobody else will come and make claims against the property. So given that, you have a different animal in a loan versus you have in a zvine. And therefore now we can reconcile all of Rav's positions. When it comes to passive publicity, there we require shtar and not dedim, because in order for it to get disseminated, there you need something that's going to do it for you, not where someone's looking into the manor, and therefore by chazoko you need a shtar. On the other hand, when it comes to achrayut nechasim, by the sale of a property, in a sale of a property, that's something that is naturally public, or that parties have an interest in it being public. For that reason, if some buyer or subsequent to that comes to buy the property, he can easily find out the information that there was a previous buyer that had a lien on the property. It's easy for him to find that information out. Nobody is hiding it. And even though, again, it's not something that passively will be disseminated, actively, if he searched, he will get that information because nobody hides a sale for all the reasons that we spoke about. On the other hand, when it comes to loans or lending, over there, we say that people do that in a private manner. Therefore, if it's done with shtar, that's something that passively disseminates information, and the person will gain a lien even on encumbered property, because that's something that everybody knows. Just like by the chazaka, the shtar is sufficient to disseminate the information, so too by a loan. But by a loan, a deem will not suffice. Even though subsequent buyers of the property will go and look into the matter, a deem should help. There's a difference, because a deem of a loan or a loan situation, people try to keep private. Since they keep it private, it's much harder to get that information. Even if you're actively looking into it, even if you're trying to find the information and there were a deem to it, it's less likely to become known because people don't want it to be publicized. They try to keep something like that under wraps. So for that reason, you have now three different views of Rav in these different areas, and we can explain all of them because of the circumstances. Each circumstance requires a different amount of publicity or a different amount of investigation in order to get the information that you're needed, that's needed. Over here is an important piece between Rav and Shmuel's statement and the Mishnah. Rav and Shmuel will make a statement, even though we're using it to show that Rav doesn't argue on the Mishnah, the truth is that Rav and Shmuel are just repeating the Mishnah. So if they're just repeating the Mishnah, then what is the Chiddush in their statement? The Mishnah says that if you lend with a shtar, then you have a lien and you have a right to go after encumbered properties. You lend with edim, you don't have that right. And all Rav and Shmuel come along and say is if you lend with edim, then you don't have that right. So what did they add to the Mishnah? So the only difference between Rav and Shmuel and the Mishnah is the parties that they mentioned there. The Mishnah mentions that if somebody lending with edim, govem minichasim b'nei chorin, you only have to go after unencumbered property, not encumbered property. Rav and Shmuel say the same thing. Eino goveh lo min alekuchot, which would be encumbered property, but lo min hayoshim. The additional line that they had there is that you're not allowed to go after an inheritor of property. Now that's a little harder to say, because why shouldn't you have a right to go after the inheritors of the property? If you extended a loan to their father, why don't then you have a right to go after the yoshim to collect your loan? So that's what the Baal Tosafot say is the chiddush of Rav and Shmuel, because they added that factor. Given that they added that factor, that also elucidates for us what their position is. And this is a chiddush that the Baal Tosafot have. Many of you shouldn't even follow this as well, but then it does present the problem in the sugya. It says, lo itzrich, This whole thing of Rav and Shmuel, we don't need El Mishum Yorshim. The Mishnah explicitly tells us about buyers of property or encumbered property. Because Savar Shibuda Lav Doraita. This is the conclusion you would come to from Rav and Shmuel's position, is that a lien is not a Torah-prescribed mechanism for collection. A lien is an institution de Rabbanan, and not something that you're entitled to min ha-Torah. Umilve b'shtar, so then what do you do with the shtar? If a lien is only something that's min de-Rabbanan, then why all of a sudden when you lend with the shtar, do you get rights that you don't have when you lend with a deem, or you lend orally? Shugoveh ha'inu shelo tinol delet b'fnei lavin. That's a rabbinic institution to keep the loan market open. Liquidity in the market depends on the fact that people will get repaid. If they don't think they're getting their money back, they won't lend their money. So in order to facilitate liquidity in the market, we said that when it's done with a shtar, you can go after encumbered property. Umecher nami mishum takanat ha-shuk. And how come by sales do we allow for there to be a warranty on the sale that there be achrayut nechasim? Again, there, that's something that if there's no shibuda doraita, you should have no right to go after that. That's takanat ha-shuk. Again, if you want people to transact in the market, you have to give them some sort of protection. If you don't allow for protection, they're not going to sell their properties. They're going to be unwilling to sell, except in exceptional cases where there's cash and there's guarantees. It'd be so hard to get a transaction done. Va'afagav d'biyoshim lo shayich lechalik. Given that, then by yoshim, why should there be any difference between a shtar and baal peh? If we say shibuda is not doraita, that means that as a lender of money, as a purchaser of property, you have no lien against the person either sold to you or borrowed the money for you. Because the Torah says there's no such thing as a lien. The Chachamim come in and they establish a lien in certain cases. So what's that? The case where you have a shtar. A case of borrowing money to create liquidity in the loan market. By a case of a purchase to create liquidity in the purchase market, in the transactional market. Yorshim. But Yorshim, they also say when you have a shtar, you're allowed to go after the Yorshim. Why? What takana is there to go after the Yorshim? What are we asking for by Yorshim? That's what the Baal Tosfot now are perplexed by, because if it's all an institution of Chachamim, you have to come up with a reason to allow you to go after Yorshim. And he says there's no reason to differentiate. By Yorshim, whether you lent with the Shtar or Yedim, you should have a right to go after them either way. Because versus the case of Likuchot and the case of Mecher and Milveh, over there there's another party who's going to lose. When you exercise your lien, you're taking away property from someone who subsequently bought the property. They're going to be a loser in this case. By Yorshim, there's no loser. The property was the guy's property. He gave it. It wasn't a purchase. They inherited the property. So when you take the property, you're not causing a loss to them. You're simply taking what belongs to you that didn't belong to their father that he gave to them. So over there, it would make sense to say, even if it was an oral loan, that you should be able to get your property back. What the Baalei Tosafot say then is, basically, in the end, what they say is that we parallel the other issues, meaning that in the same way that you want liquidity in the market in these issues, you have to create an ability to have a lien on the property. If your shim also are not paying back, then you have also now created another area of the market which will result in you not getting paid back. So people, again, will stop lending, stop transacting, because they believe the Yorshim are going to get in the way. So then why don't we say that in the case of an oral loan? Why don't we say the Yorshim are responsible? Because Yorshim is probably a higher percentage of possibility, because in the end, everybody passes away and passes the property to a Yorish. So when you're lending money or you're transacting, the likelihood that you bump into a Yorish is very high. Given that, why didn't the Rabbanan say that Yorshim always have to pay back? So he says, Aval milveh alpeh, kevin delo chashash lasot shtar legavot min lekuchot, kilo gavi nami miyatme leka nilat delet. Because in the end, if this person was willing to lend without a shtar, which means that he doesn't care about the fact that this guy could sell property afterwards and basically use up all his lien or take away the property that he possibly could have collected from, the fact that he didn't take care of himself in that way means that this guy is not so worried about it. If he's not so worried about it, we're not going to be so worried about it. And therefore, just like he doesn't have a right to go after the Kuchot, he won't have a right to go after the Yorshim. Or in essence, what the Baalei Tosafot say is, they parallel the Yorish to the other two markets, which is, basically, if you have by the Kuchot and by Milveh, there's a difference between Shtar and no Shtar, we're going to mimic that in the Yorish market, even though that's not necessarily logical. Because in the Yorish market, either you should give him the right of collection no matter what to keep liquidity in the market, or you should give him no rights because it's not blocking liquidity in the market. In the end, what we say is, yes, it blocks liquidity in the market, so we're going to give you rights. Why don't we give you rights, Baal Peh? What the Rav Tosef will point out is, if this guy doesn't take the interest himself to protect his loan, for instance, use a shtar to protect himself, then why are we going to go and try to protect him? So therefore, by Yerushim too, we say a Milvel Peh does not grant you the right to access. Given that, once you say Shibud Alabdo Raita, then you could have answered Rav's question over here. You could have answered the whole problem over here. Because if Shibud is Labdo Raita, you don't really have rights with a Shibud. And therefore, there are reasons to be Mitakein in some cases and not to be Mitakein in others. And that's why you could have explained this difference in Rav's position, which is simply to say that then according to Rav and Shmuel, the reason the Yorshim, you can't go after them is because they ain't Shibuda Doraita. It's nothing to do with Kol or not Kol. It has to do with Shibuda Doraita. If that's the case, then what's the Gemara's question from Rav and Shmuel's statement? It would have been a simple answer to deal with the issue. So how come the Gemara didn't give that answer? So why is there a question? They are Rishonim, the Ramban and others who suggest that's exactly the nature of the Gemara's question, which is, why didn't, or why is there a differentiation? Why do we differentiate between Shtar and Baal Peh? If you make such a differentiation, then if the Chachamim put a Tukana in place to allow a Shtar to be a mechanism for collection because of the Pirsum that's involved, then Rav, who believes that there's also Pirsum by Edim, should have the same Takanat Chachamim put in place with regards to Milveh. The fact that there isn't that consistency in the Takanat Chachamim, that's the question the Gemara is asking. If you're going to put a takana in place because of publicity, if shtar is a public issue, and according to Rav, a dimra public matter, they should have the same din by milveh. Why is there a distinction in the din? And that's the nature of the question over here. And the answer is that there's a difference between transactions and loans. Transactions and loans differ in their nature because one is a public affair and one is a intentionally private affair. Given that difference, the Chachamim instituted different rules in different places because they were dealing with a market or a situation where they had to respond to what were the realities of the market. And so therefore their institution is different by Mecher than it is by Milveh. Tanabanan, Achla Avshana Vaben Shtayim, if the father utilized the land for a year, and then the son utilized it for 2 years, the Sachakol, between them, they used it for a total of 3 years. Avshtaim, or the father used it for two, vaben shana, avshana, vaben shana, velokeach shana. Or you have a situation in which the father used it for a year, the son used it for a year, then sold it to a third party, and the third party used it for a year, harizo chazaka. This establishes a chazaka. Because in each of these cases, we view, first of all, the son as kare daviv. See, the son is an extension of his father. And therefore, between them, they've established a chazaka because we don't view it as being another party that came into the situation. In addition, the sale, meaning that if the son sells it with a shtar, that's a public matter. So over here, what we're trying to do is establish that people have a chazaka. What the owner of the property can argue is that every year someone else is on the property, he can argue that they're too scared to take the property. The reason that there's a new person on the property every year is because nobody is willing to stick around long enough because they know that they're going to get thrown off the property. So they do it for a year, like they're stealing it, and then they pack out. So if he sees three different parties on the property, he can just argue, I didn't say anything because they're all too scared to stay around. But if we can find a connection between the parties, which makes them really a single unit, like a father and son, because the son and the father are not viewed as being two parties, they're viewed as being a single party, they can establish a chazaka even though they're two different persons. But in the view of this situation, there's considered to be a single unit. As well, if you sell with a shtar, that's already something that's a public matter. And therefore, the continuation of the lokeach, the buyer from the previous party, they're considered to be one entity. Because people who sell with a shtar is a public matter, and the owners know that, and nobody stands around when someone else sells their property in that way. If you walk away and you let people sell your property, then they can establish a chazaka in that manner. So in this way, the three of them together can establish a chazaka, assuming that there's a tana, meaning that the original owner has to have, the father here has to have some claim as to why he got on the land. But as soon as he has a claim, then the child or the individual who bought it from the child does not have to show evidence of the fact that the father bought it. Once there's 3 years there, they can assume that there was a chazaka established. Lememra, delokeach, idleikalo. So that makes it sound like a purchaser has publicity associated with it, which is what Rav said before. Shlosha lukuchot mitztarfim. Three different buyers can be mitztareif in order to create a chazaka by which the first buyer will no longer need a contract. Same thing over here. The first buyer, who is the father in this case, will no longer have to show a contract because of the chazaka that's established. Vermini. Achla bifnei av shana, bifnei ben shtaim, bifnei av shtaim, bifnei ben shana. If a person utilized the property while the father was alive for 1 year or 2 years, and then the son inherited it, and he continued to use the property in front of the son for the subsequent years, either a year or 2 years, to make up the three, b'fnei av shana, b'fnei ben shana, b'fnei lokeach shana, or he utilized it in front of father, son, and then a buyer, he continued to use the land, harizo chazaka. That is considered to be a chazaka. V'isa kadatcha lokeach it leikalo. If you think that a buyer or purchaser is a public matter, there is no greater objection to someone else being on the property. Over here you have an individual who's been on the property for 3 years now. During those 3 years, they were different owners of the property. It was a father, a son, and then a buyer. So every year there was, let's call it, a different owner of the property. When it's the father and the son, it's easier to understand here, which is that the father and the son are considered to be one entity. And if in front of the father and the son, you kept the property, you can establish a chazaka. The Baal Tosafot point out here, it only is in a case where the son is a gadol when he inherited the property. The son was a katan when he inherited the property, you can't establish a chazaka, even when he grows up. Can't establish a chazaka. But if the son was already a gadol when he inherited the property, then you can establish a chazaka over that period of time, because now in front of this family, you have been there for 3 years and nobody's objected to that fact. But in the case where you have the father, the son, and then a buyer, that means that this individual has been, let's call it, squatting on the property. It claims that he bought it along the way. Yes, some independent fourth party was on this property, claims that he bought it, but now he's been there for 3 years. I don't need a shtar. Why? During those 3 years, the father was alive the first year. The Yoresh Ben was there the second year. And then the third year, there was a buyer. Nobody in those 3 years objected to me being here. I should be able to establish a chazaka. What the problem is that, yes, in front of the father and the son, that works. But in front of the buyer, there's no greater objection to you being on the land than when someone sells the land as if they're their owner. The son sold the land to Lokeach, demonstrating his ownership of the property. And if it's a public matter, that means that he made it clear that he thinks he owns the property. In that case, you should have to keep your shtar. You want to prove that you're really the owner of this property? You can't say, I've been here for 3 years now. Somebody just sold the property as if they owned it. So now you want to prove your ownership? You better have your shtar. So if you claim that a lokeach or a purchaser of property has publicity associated with it, that publicity should work to the effect of being an objection. Not just to the effect of establishing a chazaka, like Rav said, we have three lekuchot, and you establish a chazaka, but it should be enough the other way around, which is that if somebody who's the previous owner of the property sells it, that's also a clear objection to your sitting on the property, because they sold it while you claim you have bought this property already. That should be a warning or an objection to the point where you should have to keep your shtar or be on warning to keep your shtar around. So Mar says, Amar Papa Kitanyahi B'mocher Stotav Stam. It's a case where he sells his property without specifying this particular property. So there are two ways to read it. The Rashbam brings two ways down. The first way he brings, which he favors, is that he just sold all of his property. He never enumerated or specified the properties. It says, all my properties that I own, he sold to the buyer. The buyer now comes and says, one of those properties was this property that you've been in for 3 years. So now over there, Mocher Stotav, how is the person who's on that property to know that the other person objected through the sale? When he sold the property, he just said, I'm selling all my properties. This individual says, it's not his property anymore. That's my property. So when he sold it, he didn't sell this property. That's not a mechah. On the other hand, there is another view within the Rashbam that he actually sold the properties, and he mentioned numerous properties, including this property. But it was subsumed under a large number of other properties that he was selling. It was like a list of all of his properties, and this was included in the list. So the Rashbam rejects that view and says that already should have a kal, and he should be worried about that if it's listed amongst his properties. Others will argue that the fact that it was listed amongst a bunch of other properties, he didn't take note of it. It was just a big sale, and he didn't note it. It's when it's specifically a sale of that property, then he would worry about it. But the Rashbam rejects that and says that already is considered to be a mecha'ah, But in the case where he just sold his property by saying, Reuven says, I'm selling all my property to Shimon. And then Levi's been hanging out on this property for 3 years. And he says, nobody objected. Well, we say our sale go down. Well, that sale didn't involve this property in particular. Reuven and Shimon claim that that was involved in the sale. That Shimon says that was the property I bought. Because that was all one of Reuven's properties. Levi, who's been sitting on this property all this time, says, what are you talking about? I bought this property 3 years ago. I don't have to demonstrate my star anymore. I've been here for 3 years. Nobody said a word to me. It's my property. When he said he sold all of his properties, that's his property. It's not my property. Not the one that he previously owned. For that reason, there is no mecha'ah over here. Tosfot asks over here, why didn't the Gemara simply answer that one of these cases with a star and one of these cases with a deem without a star? And it would be a simple way to reconcile between the two cases. So the Bali Tosafot say, Eino Chanami, maybe they could have answered that. But Rav Papa felt that he had a better answer to the question that gave you a better distinction between them and gave us more information than simply saying one is with a star, one is without a star. Although the Ramban disagrees with that and says that if it is a kol, if there is publicity to this matter, it shouldn't matter whether you have a star or don't have a star. Is there publicity to a purchaser? There's no publicity to purchasers. We're not going to make that type of distinction. And therefore, that's why you have to come up with a different distinction to explain the steer between them. There are those that want to suggest that the reason you can't do that is because it's all one big Tosefta. This is all quoted from the Tosefta, and it's one big Tosefta. And therefore, you can't explain them in two different manners because it's part of one Tosefta. Given that, you need to now explain them in a consistent manner, and you can't say that it's a star in one case and a deem in the other case. Next Mishnah. Ha'umanim vashutafim varisim vapitropim ein lehem chazaka. So here the Rashba makes it clear that the chazaka that we're speaking about here is not necessarily the chazaka that we've been speaking about until now, which is the 3-year chazaka. This is a chazaka that we have by all types of property, which is possession. Possession is an indication of ownership. By metaltalim, if it's in your hands, if it's in your possession, that's a demonstration of ownership. Now by karka, shloshanim is the way to demonstrate ownership. So here, what the Mishnah is saying is that neither of these types of chazakot, or demonstrations of ownership, can be made by these parties. These parties have access, for some reason, to your possessions, to your land, to your metaltalim, but they gain that access in a manner by which would not grant them ownership. And then after that, they're trying to demonstrate ownership. So for instance, an uman, you have a craftsman that comes and takes your item to work on it, or you deliver it to him in order to work on it. You have some sort of kli that broke, and you hand him your shoes to work on. You hand him your kli to work on. Now, he has possession of the kli because he is an uman. Now, afterwards, he comes and says, oh, he sold it to me. That's why I have it in my hand. So then, he can't do that. Because since his job involves the taking of other people's possessions, by definition, he can't establish a chazaka in that way. Because anybody who gives him an item can say, I gave it to you to fix. I gave it to you to work on. And therefore, he can't establish a chazaka by simply being possession of the item. It's similar to items that are normally lent out or rented out. If people normally lend certain items or rent items, you can't establish a chazaka through possession anymore. Because the other party can always claim, I lent it to you. Your possession is not an indication of ownership. And so the uman is precluded from that. Shutaf, aris, and apitropin. These are all people who have access to the land, but not because they are buyers of the land. The shutaf has access to the land because you are partners. Your partnership gives him rights to go into your land like you have rights to go into his land. Therefore, if he is there for 3 years, that's not an establishment of chazaka by which he can say, I bought the land, it's all mine. And Aris is a sharecropper. He's allowed to go into the land, not because he owns it, but because of the nature of his job or his relationship. If he then says, I've been there for 3 years, I bought the property from him, he cannot establish a chazaka that way, because the origins of their relationship were one of a sharecropper. And the same thing with the apitropus. Now here we're probably not talking about an executor of an estate for ketanim, where it's clear he can't establish a chazaka, but even an executor of estate for gedolim, for children who are older, or someone who appoints an executor to his estate, that executor, by the nature of his position, cannot establish a chazaka in the land because he has access to the land because of his job, not necessarily because he bought it. So we're not going to grant any of these people that right to use a chazaka as a means for demonstrating ownership, They must show a shtar. They must show indications of ownership, because chazaka won't work, because we can always make a claim you're on the land because your job entitles you to be on the land, not because you bought it, not because you own the land. Therefore, their chazaka is not strong enough to establish ownership. There are others who suggest over here, like the Rabbeinu Gershom, who says here, Bali umanot shemitaknim kelim utzvaim ukovsim, launderers, dyers, all sorts of people, shemitakim begadim, shehuksuku ba, af bi shechziku b'gimu shanim, even though they kept it for 3 years, botan chafitzim, but those objects, ain't a chazaka. That's not considered to be a chazaka. Unlike the Rashbam here, the Rabbeinu Gershom says, yeah, we're talking about craftspeople, but the way they establish a chazaka is through 3 years. The Rashbam says, what are you talking about? 3 years has nothing to do with metaltalim. 3 years is a din in karka, not a din in metaltalim. And therefore what the Rashbam notes is, yes, the Rabbeinu Gershom is right. We're talking about craftspeople, but we're talking about a chazaka that can be established in a day. Possession is the way that you establish chazaka. That doesn't require 3 years. Simple possession is an indication. So unlike the Rabbeinu Gershom, he explains that it's talking about craftspeople by a day. Although the Rashbam does point out that he thinks that the Rabbeinu Gershom's girsa did not include the word umanim in there. But then it would be a derivative, as we're going to see later on in the Gemara, from the fact that shutafim don't have a chazaka. Then of course, umanim also would not have a chazaka. The other way to deal with it is to speak about craftspeople that work on your land. For instance, a builder of a wall. They're building a wall on your land, and it takes them 3 years to build the wall on the land. Those umanim can't establish chazaka by being on your land for 3 years, because the way they got to the land or accessed the land was because they were building the wall on the land. Therefore, they can't establish a chazaka. So those are different ways to view what exactly these umanim are here, and how it relates to the chazaka that we know by property. The Rashbam says it has nothing to do with that chazaka. It's the chazaka of metaltalim. That's the equivalent type of chazaka to 3 years, but just in the world of metaltalim. Rabbeinu Gershom says, yeah, it's metaltalim, but it's 3 years too, which means that he equates metaltalim, which is strange. It's not easy to understand that. Others describe it as the umanim being similar to the other members of the Mishnah, which are about karka. It's umanim that are working on the karka, and therefore they're trying to establish a chazaka of 3 years, and therefore the whole Mishnah is speaking about the 3 years of karka. So those are three different approaches to the Mishnah. Lo le'ish chazaka b'nichsei ishto. A husband cannot establish a chazaka in the property of his wife, nichsei melog, but she's entitled to use while they're married. He can't then make a claim he bought the property from her, and then when they get divorced, say it's mine, and doesn't go back to her. Below the isha chazaka b'nichsei bala, a husband is also cannot have a chazaka established by his wife in his property, because the husband is responsible for the mizonot of his wife. Therefore, he might let her go into the field and use the field as her mizonot. Or in general, spouses are not makpid on each other. Therefore, if one goes in and does something in the field, the other spouse is not going to object, because they don't assume that person is trying to establish ownership rights. It's the nature of their relationship. Below av b'nichsei ben, a father in the property of a child, below ben b'nichsei av, and a son in the property of the father. Neither of them can establish a chazaka on each other, again, because of the nature of their relationship. Fathers and sons are not makpid on each other, and therefore a son might let his father work the field, or the father might let the son work the field, not because they own it, but simply because of their relationship. And so therefore, none of these parties can establish the chazaka of 3 years. Now that chazaka is not a chazaka for demonstrating ownership, meaning that that's not a way to gain ownership over the property, it's a way to obviate the need for a shtar. So what we're saying here is all these people must keep a shtar. If there was a transaction between them, they must have evidence of the transaction, because we will not allow them to use a chazaka in place of the shtar. On the other hand, there is a different type of chazaka, which is the chazaka that establishes a kinyan. And that you could do. But that's when we're talking about someone who's trying to replace his shtar with a chazaka. These people have no right to do that, because their chazaka doesn't look like a chazaka. They could be in the property and without any objection because of the nature of the relationship, not because they really own the property. On the other hand, aval menotein matana, person who grants a gift, v'achim shichilku, brothers that divided up the estate, v'amachzik v'nichzei ager, or someone who comes to take possession of the property of a ger, which is hefger, now gadaru paratz koshu, harizo chazaka, that establishes a chazaka. Now this is the different chazaka. This is what we start in the introduction to the Perek, that there are two different types of chazaka. There's a chazaka, which is a mechanism for kinyan, which we saw in the Mishnayot and Kiddushin, which is Karka can be purchased with kesef shtar and chazaka. Money, a contract, or a chazaka. That chazaka is not the chazaka of shloshanim. It's a chazaka which shows you go in and demonstrate ownership over the property. That demonstration of ownership gives you a kinyan, gives you a acquisition of the property. It does not obviate the need for proof for the fact that you own the property, but it gives you a kinyan, which we could say that the sale was final, and the person can't back out of the sale. So what the Mishnah says is, there's a difference between these chazakot. The chazakah of shalosh shanim, of 3 years, is a way to replace the shtar. You had a kinyan some other way, and now you want to replace it with 3 years, so you don't have to keep the track of the shtar, you don't have to always prove your ownership. That you can't do with parties who are not makpid on each other. On the other hand, if there really is a transaction between them, and we have a shtar evidencing that transaction, then they can establish a chazaka on the property. What's that chazaka? That chazaka means you act like an owner on the property. When you act like an owner on the property, that gives you a kinyan on the property. What's that? Na'al, we're going to see this later on in the Mishnayot and Baba Batra as well. I'm not going to go into too much detail now. But na'al is you put up a gate or a doorway, you lock it. You do something that demonstrates ownership. Gadar is you put a fence around the property. Or paratz, you break down a fence, or you break an opening into the property. Those are demonstrations of ownership that act like a kinyan. So that could be your kinyan on the property. That doesn't give you now a right not to have to show evidence of the transaction. Still have to show a shtar or something that indicates that it was, a deem that indicates there was a transaction. But this type of chazaka can work in terms of establishing a kinyan. So what the Mishnah does is differentiates between the types of chazakot. A chazaka that has to do with replacing a shtar, replacing a kinyan, it's simply a proof that you own it, that you cannot establish. On the other hand, a chazaka that is a demonstration of a kinyan, that you can establish even with parties that you have some sort of relationship with or you have some sort of connection to. Because otherwise, how does a father buy a property from a son? Now you could demand that he do it because of a shtar, but he also has a right to do it through chazaka. Again, that chazaka will not release him from the need to show proof that he owns the property, but it will give him the right of ownership through that kinyan. The chazaka that we're speaking about at the end of the Mishnah, now gadar paratz, is a kinyan. It's the equivalent of paying money for the property. You can either pay money, have a shtar, or do a chazaka to make a kinyan on the property. It's a mechanism, or kinyan sudar. You have different mechanisms. This is one of those mechanisms. It's a totally different thing. This doesn't prove you own the property. That's when the property changed hands. That gives you the kinyan in the property. You want to prove that that happened? Bring a dim, bring a shtar. That doesn't prove anything. The kinyan is a way to have the transition of ownership happen. But you still need evidence of that transition. That evidence can be provided through a shtar, a dim, other vehicles. One of those vehicles is 3 years of chazaka on the land. That's another way to have rayah that there was a transaction. That won't work with these parties because they have a relationship which will allow you to stay on the land for 3 years without anybody ever objecting. Avua de Shmuel v'Levi, this is what I mentioned before, that Avua de Shmuel and Levi were viewed on that level with the Tanaim in a sense. V'Levi tanu shutaf ein lo chazaka. Like in our Mishnah, it seems that their Mishnah had the word shutaf in it and said shutafim don't have a right or an ability to establish a chazaka with each other. V'chol shekein uman. It seems that their Mishnah did not include the word uman in it, but that was a kol shekein. It was a kal v'chomer from the shutafim who can't establish chazaka with each other, even though they are really owners of the property, at least partial owners of the property, they still can't establish a chazaka, then Unuman, who has no real ownership over here, because everything that's given to him is really given to him to work on and to fix, then certainly he can't establish a chazaka. Shmuel Tani Uman. In Shmuel's Mishnah, the word Uman was found. Shmuel's Mishnah had Uman and lo chazaka, like our Mishnah. About Shutaf, yesh lo chazaka. But he doesn't have shutaf in the Mishnah, because the shutaf does have a chazaka. So it seems to me that they had different versions of the Mishnah. You have Avua de Shmuel and Levi, who are Talmidim of Rabbi, peers of Rabbi, and they have a Mishnah which includes the word shutaf, but doesn't include the word uman, but they see uman being an obvious outcome of shutaf that uman can't establish a chazaka. A Shmuel has a Mishnah that says uman in it, but does not say shutaf, and therefore he believes that a shutaf can establish a chazaka. V'az de Shmuel etamei, Shmuel is consistent with his position, damar Shmuel, v'shutafim machzikim ze al ze. Shutafim can establish a chazaka one on the other. Umeidim zelzeh, they can testify for each other. They're not considered to be nogeh badavar. They're not considered to be a interested party, and therefore they can't testify for their partner. They're allowed to, with another independent aid, come along and testify for their partner, and they're not considered to be a party to the transaction. Ve'nasim shomrei sachar zeh lezeh. And when they watch something of the partnership, they are considered to be a shomer sachar. That is because they are trading off favors between them. If you watch the items today, the assumption is that another day I'll watch the item. And therefore there's a quid pro quo, which is effectively payment for your watching it, is that you watch it today, I watch it tomorrow, and we already saw Bava Metzia, that establishes you as a shomer sachar. Since you're a shomer sachar, you're going to be responsible if the item is stolen, like a shomer sachar. Again, the Mara is going to break down all these statements of Shmuel. The one that's of interest to us right now is that shutafim kimi machzik zeh al zeh. That's what Shmuel says. Shmuel's consistent in his opinion that shutafim have an ability to establish a chazaka on each other. Mara says, Rami le Rabbi Abba, the Rabbi Yehuda, bimaroto debay Rabbi Zakkai. So Rabbi Abba queried of Rabbi Yehuda. Over here we have bimaroto. In the cave of the Bei Rav Zakkai, although you can see there's an alternate girsa, Bema'atzarta, the Bei Rav Zakkai, and the Atzeret of Rabbi Zakkai, which would make more sense. It was the gathering. It was a shir, or the Beit Midrash, or gathering for the shir. Mi amar Shmuel, Shutaf yesh lo chazaka. The Shmuel really believe a Shutaf has a, can establish a chazaka. So we heard Shmuel said it. We heard that he has in our Mishnah, he doesn't have the word Shutaf found in it. And now you have Rabbi Yehuda's Talmid being asked by someone else, is it really true that Shmuel holds this? Why? V'amar Shmuel, shutaf ki yored birshut dami. A shutaf that goes down and works in a property is the equivalent of going down with permission to work the property. Lav de memra, don't you conclude from that? She shutaf en lo chazaka, that a shutaf cannot establish a chazaka. So what it's saying here is that we had this in Bava Metzia, where a person goes into another party's property, and works it without permission. He goes out and he plants trees in the property. He does something to the property, even though he has no permission to be there. We had a machloket in the Amoraim over there as to what you do with that person. How do you eject him from the property? Now, he did stuff to benefit the property, but he didn't have permission to be there, but he raised the value. You pay the lower of the benefits or the cost of what he invested in the property. Yado ala tachtona. Here's an individual who did something without permission. He didn't have a right to be there. Yes, he improved the property. Yes, he invested in the property. So the owner of the property will give him the lower of the value created or the money spent, because the owner is under no obligation to pay him for any more than that. But what Shmuel says is that's all true when somebody goes without permission into the property. If you go with permission into the property, then you really do gain rights. Because if you went into the property with permission, that means that you were supposed to be there and supposed to be doing whatever it is. So that's what Shmuel says over here, that a shutaf, a partner that goes down and does work in the property, it's as if he does the work unilaterally in the property, it's as if he went down with permission, and then before he's given the rights to collect the benefit that he generated for the partnership. It's his, because he went with permission. But if you consider him to be a permitted party on the property, you can't establish a chazaka in that way. Because anybody who has permission to be on the property, their being on the property will not face an objection. There's no reason for the other partner to reject his being there or say, you don't belong here, and the fact that you didn't object grants him the right to declare his ownership here, because he's there with permission. There's an assumed permission between partners for the individual to go down and plant and do whatever he wants in the property. That assumed permission grants him rights in terms of the benefits from the property. If he does the work, he'll garner all that benefit from it. But it also imposes restrictions on his ability to establish a chazaka in that way. That seems to be a stira in Shmuel's position. Shmuel said before, shutafim can establish rights of ownership on each other. Over here, we're seeing Shmuel say just the opposite. You cannot establish rights of ownership. The Gemara says, lo kasha, it's not a problem. Hada nochit l'kula, depends how much of the property he went down and utilized. Did he utilize all the property, or did he only utilize half the property? Which is which? Some say it in that direction, some say it in the other direction, which means what's the solution to the problem can be in either way. Which means either when he takes the whole property, Then he establishes a chazaka. He is a 50% partner. The fact that he's been there for 3 years on the entire property, that gives him a right of chazaka, because the other partner should have said something. Over 3 years, he's been in the whole property. The other partner should have said something, and therefore he does establish a chazaka in that way to be the owner or claimed owner of all the property. On the other hand, if he's only in half the property, then he can't make any claims of ownership or division, because that's the way they did it. He gets 50% of the property. Even if he's on the 50%, that's the better 50%. He can't say, we split the property and this is my 50%, because the guy says, we're going to switch off. We had an agreement. He'll be there for 3 years. I'll be there for 3 years. We'll switch off the 50% of the property that each of us gets. So therefore, you can't establish a chazaka that way. That's one way to read it. The opposite way would to say just the opposite. If you possess 50% of the property for 3 years, that establishes, that's your chelek. That is your portion of the partnership, because you've been there for 3 years. The other hand, if you go down to the property and utilize the whole property for 3 years, you do not establish ownership over the whole thing, because some partnerships are developed in a manner which says, you work the whole field for 3 years, I'll work the whole field for the next 3 years. So there is such a type of partnership that doesn't do it in a way that splits it 50% all the time, but gives me 100% of the property 50% of the time. And so therefore you can't establish a chazaka bekula. So that's the two different ways to express this distinction we made in Shmuel. That sometimes you can establish a chazaka, sometimes you cannot establish a chazaka. Depends on what you're trying to do. Whether you're trying to establish your rights to 50% of the property, or whether you're trying to establish your rights to 100% of the property. And again, we had it in both directions. You could see it in both ways. And then Ravina offers an alternative way to reconcile Shmuel. Ha, va, the nochet, the kula. Both cases he went to take ownership of 100% of the property. Velo kasha, the ipe din chaluka, the lepe din chaluka. Depends on the nature of the property. If the property is a divisible property, then your being on 100% of the property for 3 years seems strange. Why would the other guy give you 3 years to use the whole property and not demand his 50% of the property during that period? That's a chazaka to establish ownership. If you want to make sure that your rights are not abrogated by this guy being there for 3 years and saying, I bought it from you, you better do something about it. On the other hand, if it's a property that is indivisible, then of course, the only way their partnership is going to work is if you take it for 3 years, or you take it for a certain amount of time, 100% of it, and then I take it 100% of it. Because if we split it, it's not going to be efficient for either of us to use it. Therefore, since it's a property that's not omeid, the chalek, it's not omeid to split, therefore the nature of the partnership is you use it 100% for 50% of the time, and I'll use it 100% for 50% of the time, therefore you can't establish a chazaka, because that would be the natural way to create the partnership over here. We saw such an example of that before. The Kaimelon Bach Uvda Derami Barchama Ravukva Barchama. The two brothers, the Zamin Avata B'Shutafut. They bought a maidservant in partnership. And the way they utilized the maidservant is that he got it 1 year, she got it the other year. He got it 1 year, he got it the other year. The Gemara over there said, why did they do this? So that each party could not establish a chazak on the other. The two brothers exercise a chazak against each other. Just like you can't exercise a chazak against each other, so too, you cannot establish a chazak against a third party. That's what he said. You can never establish, because you tried to make it that you can't establish 3 years in a row. That means for other parties also, you're not successful together to generate 3 years in a row. The Rashbam says, isn't a shifcha, ain't a nitan l'chaluka. It's somebody who can't be divided. A shifcha can't be divided in half. So since you can't be divided in half, the only way for you to utilize her is b'serugim, is alternately. Each one of them will use 100% of the shifcha for 50% of the time. So then, there was no way that they could establish a chazaka on each other. So why did they do this alternating year thing? Because there was no way that they could establish chazaka on each other, because this is something that can't be split. And we just said now, partners who have property that can't be split can't establish a chazaka. So the Rashbam answers in the end, like what the Gemara says over there, which is that they did it because other people might not know that they were in a partnership. So in order to prevent others from thinking that one of the two parties bought it and therefore it was theirs, they did it in this alternating years to indicate that they were partners in this shifcha, and that no one party could establish a chazaka, not because they thought they could establish a chazaka, but maybe others don't know their partners, or others don't know the relationship between them. Gemara now, we'll finish off with Gufa. Amar Shmo Shutaf Ki Yoreid Birshut Dami. A shutaf has the status as if he went down with permission. My kamash malon. What is that teaching us? Shutafut ain lo chazaka. that if it's coming to teach us that a shutaf doesn't have a chazaka, which is one of the things we did conclude here, lema shutaf ain't no chazaka. Say it straight out. The whole point of saying that he's there with permission to say a shutaf cannot establish a chazaka against his partner, then say it straight out. Our Mishnah would, like our Mishnah, says shutaf ain't no chazaka. Shmuel says shutaf yesh lo chazaka, and he has another statement, shutaf ain't no chazaka, and we reconcile them, but let him just say it straight out. So Amrav Nachman, Amrav Avua, Lomar, Shnotel b'shevach ha-megiyah le-ketfayim, b'sadeh she'en asuya lita, k'sadeh anasuya lita. This goes back to that Gemara in Baba Metzia, which says that if you go down without permission, what are your rights when you go down without permission? We said there, if it's a field that should have been planted with trees, and you go ahead and plant it with trees, then all you did was what the owner of the property was going to do anyway with this property. He was going to plant trees, so you plant trees. So let him pay you whatever he was going to pay someone else for those services, and you'll get your money's worth out of it. On the other hand, if it's a field that is not normally planted, and you went ahead and planted it, what are your rights? So if you are someone that was there without permission, then you don't get any of the shevach. You're not necessarily entitled to the shevach because you did it without permission. And therefore, the party will pay you the lower of cost or benefit, whichever is lower here. That's what he'll pay you for what you did in the field because it wasn't a field that was made for planting trees. So then if you went down with permission into a field that wasn't made for planting trees and you did plant trees, since you went down with permission, you are entitled to not only to payment, the lower of cost or benefit, you get the whole benefit. You get even shevach amagia leketfayim. You get shevach that magia leketfayim argument we've seen before in the Gemara. Magia leketfayim, Rashi says, Bali Tosfot quote Rashi here, the Rashbam as well says it over here. It's talking about items that are fully ripened. Items that are no longer need the karka or not necessarily part of the karka. That's the shevach amagia leketfayim. It's something where the item's already ripe and fully ready to be picked. At that point, you get to keep that shevach because you went down with permission. Had you gone down without permission, you wouldn't have a right to that shevach. On the other hand, the Bali HaTosafot, the Rabbeinu Tam, in many places argues on this explanation of Rashi and brings the shevach ha-magil ketfayim is something that requires ketfayim. It requires your input to make it work. There's a difference between improvements in the property that come from your effort and improvements in the property that come from memela that happen naturally in the property. And a shevach ha-magil ketfayim is improvements in the property from your work. The benefits are a direct result of your investment or the work that you put into the property. So that's a shevach ha-magil ketfayim according to the Rabbeinu Tam. So that you're entitled to if you went down with permission. If you went down without permission, you're not entitled to that shevach ha-magil ketfayim. Or in essence, permission gives you a right to garner the benefit of the property. On the other hand, if you go without permission, you're not going to get that shevach ha-magia leketfayim. So therefore, this partner that goes down and works the property is entitled not only to 100% of his half of the partnership, but also 50% or whatever the normal rights of an aris or a sharecropper are in his friend's 50% of the partnership because he went ahead and did all the work. And even though his friend was not aware of it, it's as if he went down with the shoot and he can make a claim for the benefits, not only from his own property, but even from his friend's property, because he did all the work. On the other hand, the Ramban brings, and the Rabbeinu Chananel explains it this way as well, that there is another way to view this, which is that because they are shutafim, therefore, if one of them works the whole property, he went down with permission, and he gets no rights to any of this. It still remains a 50-50 split, because the other party didn't object to him being there or let him do this because that's the nature of their partnership. Partnership allows each party to garner 50% no matter who is doing the work or who's doing the investing in the property. And therefore, what it means is that since you went down with permission, you get all of the value in your 50%, and your partner gets all of the value in his 50%, even shevach ha-magia leketfayim. Even the stuff that you worked and only came about because of your work, he is still entitled to that 50% because that's the nature of your partnership. And you went down with quote unquote reshut, means that you went down under the auspices of the partnership. And that is a 50-50 split. So there are two different ways to explain what it means here that you went down with reshut, means that you get the shevach ha-magia leketfayim. Okay, we're going to stop here by the two dots on the bottom of Membet, Amudbet.